Before I start the show, I just wanted to give a shout out. Thank you very much to DK Moon, who has contributed to my Patreon. DK is my new Thunderwalker. I really, really appreciate you. I appreciate your help. It means a lot to me. It's humbling, and yeah, you're wonderful. Thank you. My shout out to you. And yeah, thank you. Stone won't fall until the podcast of the dragon comes to your device. Hey everybody, my name is Morgan. You might know me as the Grey Warder on Twitter and Discord. Welcome to the 21st episode of Podcast of the Dragon. Who dabbles in botany and beguilement with equal delight? Farron, who else? In today's episode, I'm diving into her character to examine her actions and motivations as I follow her arc from our first meeting at the start of the Great Hunt through her point of view in The Dragon Reborn. Come along as I speculate on her thoughts and feelings and contemplate what's behind her choice to immediately leave Tarvalen for some backwater in the hinterlands of Andor. The Wheel of Time is a story with an enormous cast of characters, which is one of the things that makes it so great. Robert Jordan sort of surrounds his central characters with secondary and tertiary characters that he brings to life in such a way that even when we don't see them that often or we hardly ever get their point of view, they are incredibly impactful. And a lot of them are characters that aren't absolutely necessary to the story, where the things that they do could, if the showrunners so choose, be handled in a different way while still getting done. These are people like Talmanez and Pevara or Ingtar, fan favorites that people can get really invested in because RJ is so good at making them interesting and compelling and giving them all their own stories. But my personal favorite, and frankly I think she is a cut above all of the rest, is Verin. I find Verin just absolutely delightful. She's an example of a character who is very much like Moraine in the sense that she is an enigma, both inside and out. Even with the rare times that we get her point of view, it's like she's still mostly inscrutable. Unlike those mysterious internal narratives where we get to see inside Moraine's head, Verin's motives are totally murky, and because we get far fewer of her POVs, she's just always this person kind of out floating around, doing her own thing, occasionally coming in to lend aid and assistance, but you can't help but wonder what's her game. And there's always this sense of whatever her game is, her ultimate desire is to please herself. I never realized that she was a dark friend until the whole reveal of, by the way, that dress you're wearing is green in The Gathering Storm, when she comes to Egwene and gives her her little black book with all the names of the Black Aja. Because no matter how many times I reread The Great Hunt, I never picked up on Moraine at the end of the book telling Rand that indeed she did not send Verin, and actually holding that up and comparing that to Verin flat out telling Ingtar, Moraine sent me. Someone actually had to point that out to me because I just never picked it up. But when I found out, I wasn't exactly surprised. And it was honestly so perfect the way that it was done, set up so that it comes across like a cliche 11th hour betrayal. And then after a moment's suspense, you learn, no, she didn't betray, she's a triple agent. It seemed so perfect and logical that Verin would tread too far purely out of curiosity searching for the Black Aja, not doing it out of a sense of wanting to see justice done, or because dark friends are evil and she wants to fight the dark one because that's her duty as an Aes Sedai. No. She followed the trail of the Black Aja because her curiosity is so strong, and ultimately feeding her curiosity is her number one priority. She got a whisper of the Black Aja and went after it purely for whatever her dopamine kick is that she gets when something engages her interest. But, oops, she goes too far and then gets caught where it's sort of like, oh, yeah, I totally was gonna swear, that's why I'm here. And she chooses to swear her soul to the shadow rather than choosing to die, because that's her choice, swear or die. And so many people would have been like, oh well, the game is up and I'm going to choose death, which is both understandable, because who the fuck wants to serve the shadow? And noble, and the sort of choice that the Emmons Fielders or Elaine would make, they'd be like, do your worst, fuck you, I'm not swearing my soul to the shadow. And it's easy to identify with that. And it's also easy to put yourself in someone's shoes and understand what it would be like to be so terrified and fearful of death and so attached to your own skin that you just don't have the courage to go out in a blaze of defiance. It's easy to picture swearing your soul to the shadow out of self-interest and fear. But Varen didn't swear out of fear. I'm sure she was frightened, and I'm sure she felt like, oh man, I fucked up. She also sees an awesome opportunity to feed what she values most, which is her curiosity. And I'm sure she saw that in swearing to the shadow, she had a chance to do some good with it and to make the best of a bad situation. But for Varen, she's the kind of person where the good is almost an afterthought. Like, it's what she does so that she can keep the balance scale even, and offset the wrong that she's going to end up doing because she has sworn her soul to the shadow. And that makes her as a character morally gray at best, because she doesn't come across as troubled knowing that she's going to have to do wrong, and her thought in doing what she's doing isn't necessarily, this will be good for the light, this is for justice, this is for truth, I will do this thing and make this sacrifice. She just thinks of the knowledge. And yet we love her, and most of us who love her with this sense of, ah, that's just barren. You know, we forgive her for her wrongs. It's hard not to love a character who has this air that RJ imbues her with, where she is benevolent and devious and potentially evil, and you're never quite sure with her. And it's like you want to trust her because she seems so kind and warm and like she couldn't possibly mean you any harm, even though there's always this slight sense of misgiving. And that makes her incredibly compelling. We're first introduced to Varen at the beginning of the Great Hunt in Chapter 4, and RJ makes use of her from the beginning to show us what it means to be Brown Aja. Because he has limited resources as far as how much of the Great Hunt he can commit to world-building with the Aes Sedai, RJ uses the beginning scenes in Faldara to do what he can to paint some small pictures, and he makes use of Moraine being summoned to Swan to show a handful of different Aes Sedai. And through Moraine's observations, he tells us a few things. It says, Varen Mathwin and Seraphel of the Brown Aja did not look up at Moraine's entrance. Seraphel was intently reading an old book with a worn, faded leather cover, handling its tattered pages carefully, while plump Varen, sitting cross-legged beneath an arrow slit, held a small blossom up to the light and made notes and sketches in a precise hand in a book balanced on her knee. She had an open inkpot on the floor beside her, and a small pile of flowers on her lap. The Brown sisters concerned themselves with little besides seeking knowledge. Moraine sometimes wondered if they were really aware of what was going on in the world, or even immediately around them. So RJ gives us our first picture of the Brown Aja, and he just shows us these hardcore nerds and nerding. We see Varen twice in the Great Hunt, before the scene where she reads Moraine and Swan the dark prophecy that was written on the wall of the dungeon, and then just so smoothly snakes her way into their council. And RJ does a wonderful job subtly emphasizing her importance and drawing attention to her. The first time we see her, she's one of the two Brown sisters in the antechamber. Seraphel is described as reading a book, but Varen's description is much more detailed and she's being much more active. She's sketching and holding blossoms up to the light. Her lap is full of flowers, which presumably she picked recently, so there's like a story behind that you can make for yourself. She's the character that commands attention, and RJ gives her a last name as well. The second time that we see Varen is after the Trollocs attack the keep and steal the horn. Rand is in the dungeon, standing around, talking to Inktar, and it says, "They were in the dungeon guard room now. The severed heads and the pieces of the guards had been removed, though there were still red smears on the table and damp patches in the straw to show where they had been. Two Aes Sedai were there, placid-looking women with brown fringed shawls, studying the words scrawled on the walls, careless of what their skirts dragged through in the straw. Each had an inkpot and a writing case hung at her belt and was making notes in a small book with a pen. They never even glanced at the men trooping through. 'Look here, Varen,' one of them said, pointing to a section of stone covered with lines of Trolloc script. 'This looks interesting.' The other scurried over, picking up reddish stains on her skirts. 'Yes, I see. A much better hand than the rest. Not a Trolloc. Very interesting,' she began writing in her book, looking up every so often to read the angular letters on the wall. Rand hurried out. Even if they had not been Aes Sedai, he would not have wanted to remain in the same room with anyone who thought reading Trolloc script written in human blood was interesting. So, I'm terrible, and I think that's fucking hilarious. It's a great little scene. RJ draws attention to Varen again, having Seraphel call to her and setting us up so that when, come morning, she reads the translation to Moraine and Swan, we know who she is. This is the nerdy botanist with a lap full of flowers sitting in the sun who is so clinical-minded and unfazed that she doesn't care if she walks through a puddle of blood and drags her skirt through it, at least not if her curiosity is stimulated enough. And I can see Varen going into the dungeon and getting so excited for this kind of forensic study to just kind of look in and imagine what exactly happened, what must have gone down. I can just see her looking at the entire scene and being super excited by it, because I'm sure she wasn't expecting entertainment, what amounts to major entertainment for her, when she went on this visit of state. It's sort of like, oh, well, I'll take this time when I'm on this visit to Shinar to pluck some flowers and do some botany because I haven't had access to this species of plant before. Holy shit, I'm going to do some forensic study in this bloody dungeon? I wasn't expecting this. This is fucking cool. And for Varen, it is so much more than that, too, because you know when you're looking at the text and you're looking at her character, for each choice that she makes, you kind of have to ask yourself, is she doing what she's doing under her own agency, or is it being done under the Shadow's orders? So I'm looking at the scene in the dungeon, and I'm asking myself, how much does she know behind the scenes about the attack on the keep? Or what does she surmise based upon what she does know? I'm guessing that she doesn't know very much. Dark friends are good at keeping secrets from each other, and they're very much on a need-to-know basis. We never hear where she ranks among the Black Aja, but knowing Varen's style, I don't think she's very important at all. She gives off this utter affectation of derpiness, and I feel like she makes use of it almost more to move through the world of the Black Aja than she does to move through the world of the regular Aes Sedai. Because Varen is living in this role of the triple agent, which is not a comfortable place to exist. When you live in this precarious place like she does, making people believe you're kind of scatterbrained and disorganized is smart. It's an armor. And I think she uses it most of all among her evil peers and overlords. She disarms them by appearing useless. She's too caught up in her own nerdery to be capable of situational critical thinking or common sense. And I think that in that way, she makes herself easily overlooked, and it helps her to be underutilized as a dark friend Aes Sedai, and I think that in doing so, it helps her to keep her acts of evil to a minimum, because I imagine that she just kind of flies under the radar, and every once in a while, they're like, oh yeah, there's Varen too, we can send her out to do some terrible deed, but Varen is just so good at disarming people so that even when they don't trust her, and no one in the Black Aja trusts anyone, they won't perceive her as a threat. I think they barely perceive her at all, and that leaves her to lurk in the background and take notes and bask in that constant dopamine fix that is her stimulated curiosity. And I just have this view of her, like, no matter how shitty it is, no matter how horrible everything that's going down is, she's delighted with all of it because that's just kind of the person that she is. So, in the prologue of The Path of Daggers, we get a point of view from Varen where she's out in the Aiel camp, she's an apprentice because she's sworn fealty to Rand, and she's thinking to herself about how she has developed prattling to an art form. She cultivates this aura of derpiness by running at the mouth, and she just chatters away about bullshit or about stuff that just isn't important or interesting. And she comes across in a way that people are just kind of like, ignore her, or they tune her out, or just basically the minute that she comes into a room, they're immediately only half paying attention to her. Because they're like, when Varen opens her mouth, the stuff that pours out isn't even worth giving it much thought, because she just goes on, and most of what she says is practically useless, because she prattles like a champ. But I don't know that it's 100% an affectation. RJ gives us some prime examples of her prattling while the Aes Sedai are in Fal'Dara, just beautifully painting her character. And there's this great bit in the chapter called The Dragon Reborn, when Moraine is telling Rand, hey, I can't help you learn how to channel, and she gives him the bird can't teach a fish to fly, fish can't teach a bird to swim adage. And it says, I've always thought that was a bad saying, Varen said suddenly. There are birds that dive and swim, and in the Sea of Storms are fish that fly, with long fins that stretch out as wide as your outstretched arms, and beaks like swords that can pierce. Her words trailed off, and she became flustered. Moraine and the Ammerlin seat were staring at her without expression. I feel like this right here is an example of Varen genuinely getting caught up in a moment, since she's actually sometimes prone to prattling. Varen plays up her natural traits, which I understand. You know, I have a natural flair to every once in a while be dramatic, and I'll play that up because sometimes it's fun to just turn your personality up to 11. And so Varen makes use of her tendency to prattle, and RJ in the scene shows Varen as she's just going off about how stupid the saying is, being incredibly genuine. But at this point in the narrative, we've already had the scene where she weaponizes Swan's and Moraine's assumptions about her as she's telling them about the writing in the dungeon. So it's after they've done the work on Matt to try to protect him or buffer him because the dagger's been stolen. It says, the door closed behind Lyanna and the litter bearers, and the Ammerlin drew an unsteady breath. A nasty business, that. Nasty. Her face was smooth, but she rubbed her hands together as if she wanted to wash them. But quite interesting, Varen said. She had been the fourth Aes Sedai the Ammerlin had chosen for the work. It is too bad we do not have the dagger so the healing could be complete. For all we did tonight, he will not live long. Months, perhaps, at best. The three Aes Sedai were alone in the Ammerlin's chambers. Beyond the arrow slits, dawn pearled the sky. But he will have those months now, Moraine said sharply, and if it can be retrieved, the link can still be broken. If it can be retrieved. Yes, of course. It can still be broken, Varen agreed. She was a plump, square-faced woman, and even with the Aes Sedai gift of agelessness, there was a touch of gray in her brown hair. That was her only sign of age, but for an Aes Sedai, it meant she was very old indeed. Her voice held steady, though, matching her smooth cheeks. He has been linked to the dagger for a long time, however, as a thing like that must be reckoned, and he will be linked longer yet, whether it is found or not. He may already be changed beyond the reach of full healing, even if no longer enough to contaminate others. Such a small thing, that dagger, she mused, but it will corrupt whoever carries it long enough. He who carries it will in turn corrupt those who come in contact with him, and they will corrupt still others, and the hate and suspicion that destroyed Shadrlogoth, every man and woman's hand turned against every other, will be loose in the world again. I wonder how many people it can taint in, say, a year. It should be possible to calculate a reasonable approximation. Moraine gave the brown sister a wry look. Another danger confronts us, and she sounds as if it is a puzzle in a book. Light, the Browns truly are not aware of the world at all. Then we must find the dagger, sister. Agomar is sending men to hunt those who took the horn and slew his oathman, the same who took the dagger. If one is found, the other will be. So, Varen was specifically picked by Swan to work on Matt. When Moraine is telling Swan before the dagger and the horn are stolen, when they're first talking, that there's a problem with Matt, Swan's like, yeah, I can probably find some sisters who could be trusted not only to keep their mouths shut when we work on him and heal him, but not just to see the shadow anywhere. And so she chooses Varen. She sees Varen as someone who can be trusted, and Varen's totally down because any chance for knowledge excites her. So she's like, fuck yeah, I won't say a word. This is so cool. And Varen takes advantage of this moment. And I'm wondering if she had been planning on trying to find a way to talk to Swan to be like, okay, so, you know, there was writing on the wall of the dungeon. Can we talk about this, Mother? Can I get a moment of your time, Mother? You know, something. But instead she has this perfect moment that she could not let pass up, where she has not only Swan, but Moraine. She has them alone. And so she just quickly slides into their council. She's got her translation of her poem. And so she's very casually like, hey, do you want to see what was on the dungeon? And Swan's like, yeah. So she reads them the blood feeds blood, blood calls blood, and they talk about it and are discussing it. And finally, they can't come to any decision about it being dark prophecy. And so the Amaryllin is finally like, okay, well, you need to fuck off, Varen. And it says, and of course, Varen said calmly, the man who channels must be one of the three young men traveling with you, Moraine. Moraine stared in shock. Not aware of the world. I am a fool. Before she realized what she was doing, she had reached out to the pulsing glow she always felt there waiting, to the true source. The one power surged along her veins, charging her with energy, muting the sheen of power from the Amaryllin seed as she did the same. Moraine had never before even thought of wielding the power against another Aes Sedai. We live in perilous times, and the world hangs in the balance, and what must be done. It must. Oh, Varen, why did you have to put your nose in where it does not belong? Varen closed her book and slipped it back behind her belt, then looked from one woman to the other. She could not but be aware of the nimbus surrounding each of them, the light that came from touching the true source. Only someone trained in channeling herself could see the glow, but there was no chance of any Aes Sedai missing it in another woman. A hint of satisfaction settled on Varen's face, but no sign that she realized she had hurled a lightning bolt. She only looked as if she had found another piece that fit in a puzzle. Yes, I thought it must be so. Moraine could not do this alone, and who better to help than her girlhood friend who used to sneak down with her to snitch sweet cakes? She blinked. Forgive me, Mother, I should not have said that. Varen... Varen, the Amaryllin shook her head wonderingly, you accuse your sister and me of, I won't even say it, and you were worried that you've spoken too familiarly to the Amaryllin seat? You bore a hole in the boat and worry that it's raining. Think what you were suggesting, daughter. It is too late for that, Swan, Moraine thought. If we had not panicked and reached for the source, perhaps then. But she is sure now. Why are you telling us this, Varen? She said aloud. If you believe what you say, you should be telling it to the other sisters, to the Reds in particular. Varen's eyes widened in surprise. Yes, yes, I suppose I should. I hadn't thought of that. But then if I did, you would be stilled, Moraine, and you, Mother, and the man gentled. No one has ever recorded the progression in a man who wields the power. When does the madness come exactly, and how does it take him? How quickly does it grow? Can he still function with his body rotting around him? For how long? Unless he is gentled, what will happen to the young man, whichever he is, will happen whether or not I am there to put down the answers. If he is watched and guided, we should be able to keep some record with reasonable safety, for a time at least. And too, there is the Greith and Cycle. She calmly returned their startled looks. I assume, Mother, that he is the Dragon Reborn. I cannot believe you would do this, leave walking free a man who can channel, unless he was the Dragon. She thinks only of the knowledge, Moraine thought wonderingly. The culmination of the direst prophecy the world knows, perhaps the end of the world, and she cares only about the knowledge, but she is still dangerous for that. So, this scene, which is a wonderful scene, it's one of those where the question of who's in charge of Varen's actions is really open to debate. But personally, I don't think Varen was at the Dark Friends social, and so I don't think she went to Faldara with a mission. And obviously there are other ways to receive orders, but significant characters doing villainous things in the Great Hunt usually come from the starting place of the Dark Friend social, and I don't think she's important enough to have been there. We know that Leandrin was there, because Leandrin, when she goes to Tanchico, you get the scene where she goes to Jacob Carradine's house to harass him about the White Cloaks taking over the Panarch's palace, and she calls him Bors, so Leandrin was for sure at the Dark Friend social. And I think Alviarin has to be the other one who was there, since Alviarin is the head of the Black Aja, and Alviarin, along with Leandrin, is also in the party of Aes Sedai at Faldara. And Bors, in his observation and his narrative, specifically sees two Aes Sedai. So, I definitely don't think that Varen was important enough to be at the social, and I think that this scene of her insinuating herself into Moraine and Swan's machinations surrounding the dragon is entirely her own choice, but I'm wondering if the reason that the Black Aja didn't kill or torture Swan to learn the nature of the meetings that she had with the boys is because Varen could just tell them what went down, or she could at least tell them what she wanted them to know. Because being a triple agent, she could inform and just sort of be like, yeah, we talked about X, Y, or Z. And at that point, Varen has all the power to dribble out whatever information she feels that she can get away with giving the Shadow, and at the same time, she gets to protect Swan and Moraine and protect the boy as well. When we first meet her in Faldara, RJ paints Varen as this spacey sister to the point where she's really flustered during the very tense meeting with Rand when she just gets this thought in her head of, yeah, that's a really shitty saying, and kind of runs off at the mouth with it, and then totally trails off because Moraine and Swan are staring at her like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is not the time. When Varen leaves the Amarlin's party, as they're all headed to the Arranan to take ship down to Tar Valon, and she goes after the hunters for the horn, we see her again for the first time since that meeting with Rand. RJ shows her to us again, and this time we get to see her both as she is and as she wants to be seen. So she catches up and she says, Moraine Sedai sent me, Lord Ingtar, Varen announced with a satisfied smile. She thought you might need me. Such a gallop I've had, I thought I might not catch you short of Kaer Rhian. You saw that village, of course. Oh, that was very nasty, wasn't it? And that murderer. There were ravens and crows all over the rooftops, but never a one went near it, dead as it was. I had to wave away the Dark One's own weight and flies, though, before I could make out what it was. A shame I did not have time to take it down. I've never had a chance to study it. Suddenly her eyes narrowed and the absent manner vanished like smoke. Where is Randall Thor? So she's prattling as she does, and she's doing that on purpose, affecting her prattling because she wants to disarm them. She wants them to think, oh, this is the spacey Aes Sedai. Moraine sent her so that we would have an Aes Sedai with us, but she's basically this harmless nerd who never shuts up. And her enthusiasm, particularly about the murderer, it's almost like it snowballs in the midst of her act. She comes up and she's doing her act, such a gallop, might not catch you short of Kaer Rhian, you saw that village. And then it's like she starts to get into the whole thing with the murderer, and her affectation of prattling kind of gets wrapped up into her own enthusiasm, because the idea of being able to take the murderer down and study it makes her so fucking excited, and she would have been so happy to be able to take it down and look it over, and so she immediately goes from her affectation of prattling to literally running at the mouth because she's actually so enthused and her curiosity has just gotten a hold of her. And then she just stops because she's noticed that Rand is gone and suddenly she is all business and she's not prattling now. And it's just like, where's Randall Thor? And once RJ has her catch up to the hunters, this Varen that we've been introduced to changes. Or at least our perceptions change, because mostly we've perceived her from Moraine's point of view. So we've seen her from the point of view of an Aes Sedai where Varen is lower rank. She's an Aes Sedai that has to defer to Moraine, or defer to Swan because of power levels. Or you see her from Rand's point of view, in a meeting where she's running her mouth, and the Amarlin and Moraine stare daggers at her because she sounds like an idiot. Or else she's a nerd in a dungeon, being like, oh, the shit written on the wall in blood is awesome! But all of those perceptions of her are very different from the perception that we get now, where she is the only Aes Sedai among men who defer to her and fear her. She's no longer presented to us in this position of a bumbling mentor who pulled this fast one on Moraine and Swan. Now she's someone that your POV characters feel incredibly wary of. Suddenly, she manages to be, while still kind of derpy and yet benevolent, also dangerous and in charge at the same time. It says, I can have two men escort you back to where they disappeared, Varen Sedai. They will have no trouble taking you right to it. No. If you say they vanished without a trace, for a long moment she studied Ingtar, her face unreadable. I will ride with you. Perhaps we will find them again, or they will find us. Talk to me as we ride, Lord Ingtar. Tell me everything you can about the young man. Everything he did, everything he said. They started off in a jingle of harness and armor, Varen riding close beside Ingtar and questioning him closely, but too low to be overheard. She gave Perrin a look when he tried to maintain his place, and he fell back. "It's a ranch she's after," Matt murmured, "not the horn." Perrin nodded. "Wherever you've gotten to, Rand, stay there. It's safer than here." Whether or not she was ordered by Alviarin / the Black Aja to follow Rand, Varen's goal in doing so is to fight the Shadow. And I am sure that if she did get the orders from the Black Aja, she was like, "Yes, fucking great orders. I can do a lot of good with this, and fuck yeah, I want to follow these Ta'veren. I am so curious about them." And Varen is the kind of person who will find fuel for her curiosity wherever, but, you know, when you've got Ta'veren to work with, that's next fucking level. So, you can see here that she feels just desperately crunched for time. Like, she rode her horse really hard to catch up to them. She wants to catch up to Rand, and in thinking about it, because there is no way to determine whether she's there under orders or not, and I think RJ wrote her that way on purpose, so that you would just never know. In doing so, that gives her more agency, which is kind of nice. And personally, I believe that Varen decided to go, and I like that idea. It makes sense, because she finds Rand gone and she feels major anxiety. And it's palpable in the way that she wants to talk to Ingtar and know, hey, what all happened here? And you cut away from Perrin's point of view, and you get a whole bunch of chapters from Rand, and you see the girls in the tower. And the next time you get back to the hunters, they've reached Kyrian, and they're in Kinslayer's Dagger, and they've run into the Aielman. They find Urien, the Red Shield, in the mountains, and he shows himself to them. It says, "Why are you here, so far from your own lands?" she asked. "Why did you come to us? You could have remained in the rocks, and we would never have known you were there." The Aiel hesitated, and she added, "Tell only what you were willing to say. I do not know what your wise ones do, but I'll not harm you or try to force you." "So the wise ones say," Urien said dryly. "Yet even a clan chief must have a strong belly to avoid doing as they want." He seemed to be picking his words carefully. "I search for someone, a man." His eye ran across Perrin, Matt, the Shinarans, dismissing them all. "He who comes with the dawn. It is said there will be great signs and portents of his coming. I saw that you were from Shinar by your escort's armor, and you had the look of a wise one, so I thought you might have word of great events, the events that might herald him." "A man?" Varen's voice was soft, but her eyes were as sharp as daggers. "What are these signs?" Urien shook his head. "It is said we will know them when we hear of them, as we will know him when we see him, for he will be marked. He will come from the west, beyond the spine of the world, but be of our blood. He will go to Roydian and lead us out of the threefold land." He took a spear in his right hand. Leather and metal creaked as soldiers reached for their swords, and Perrin realized he had taken hold of his axe again, but Varen waved them all to stillness with an irritated look. In the dirt, Urien scraped a circle with his spear point, then drew across it a sinuous line. "It is said that under this sign he will conquer." Ingtar frowned at the symbol, no recognition on his face, but Matt muttered something coarsely under his breath, and Perrin felt his mouth go dry. "The ancient symbol of the Aes Sedai." Varen scraped the marking away with her foot. "I cannot tell you where he is, Urien," she said, "and I have heard of no signs or portents to guide you to him." "Then I will continue my search." It was not a question, yet Urien waited until she nodded before he eyed the Shinarans proudly, challengingly, then turned his back on them. He walked away smoothly and vanished into the rocks without looking back. Some of the soldiers began muttering. Uno said something about crazy bloody Aiel, and Massima growled that they should have left the Aiel for the ravens. "We have wasted valuable time," Ingtar announced loudly. "We will ride harder to make it up." "Yes," Varen said, "we must ride harder." Ingtar glanced at her, but the Aes Sedai was staring at the smudged ground where her foot had obliterated the symbol. "Dismount," he ordered. "Armor on the pack horses. We're inside Kyrian now. We do not want the Kyrian in thinking we have come to fight them. Be quick about it." Matt leaned close to Perrin. Do you think he was talking about Rand? It's crazy, I know, but even Ingtar thinks he's Aiel." "I don't know," Perrin said. "Everything's been crazy since we got mixed up with Aes Sedai." Softly, as if to herself, Varen spoke, still staring at the ground. "It must be a part, and yet how? Does the Wheel of Time weave threads into the pattern of which we know nothing? Or does the Dark One touch the pattern again?" Perrin felt a chill. Varen looked up at the soldiers removing their armor. Hurry, she commanded with more snap than Inktar and Uno combined. We must hurry. So, her desire to fight the shadow is really obvious here. She's anxious. The dragon is missing, and now there's an extra threat with the Aiel, a thing that adds to her mental picture, but it's hard to guess what it means and whether it's good or ill. I'm wondering if maybe the dark prophecy from the wall made her think that Rand should not be without Aes Sedai aid, despite the fact that Swan and Moraine decided to let him go his own way, and that's why she's here. Not on orders, but because she felt that Swan and Moraine letting him go off on his own was not smart. So I've wondered if maybe RJ originally planned for Varen to be at the Darkfront Social, because at Barthana's party, she's seen talking to both Barthana's and Inktar. And we know for sure both of them went to the Darkfront Social. At least we know for sure that Inktar went there, and it's safe to assume that Barthana's did, too. The man who calls himself Bors sees a Terranhide lord there, and a Domani Bloodborn, and a noble Illioner, so it is reasonable to assume that the high seat of the second most powerful house in Kyrian would be there. So I don't know that RJ specifically had Varen talking to both Barthana's and Inktar, dark friends who were at the social, to be like an Easter egg and tell us that she was there too, or just to hint that she too is on the side of evil. But it's fun to look at those two interactions and speculate on what was said between the Aes Sedai and the individual lords. I feel like Varen would not have said anything to Barthana's to indicate that she was a dark friend or that she knew that he was a dark friend. So, Hurin tells Rand, Varen Sedai was with Barthana's. She gave me such a look when I came near I never even tried to tell her. So, I feel like she was probably having a pretty ordinary conversation with him. And I can see Varen amusing herself by saying cryptic things to Barthana's to make him uncomfortable. But I think that she would see absolutely no profit in touching upon the shadow with him. Once Rand, Loyal, and Hurin climb over the wall into where the Ogier Grove was and open the way gate and see that Machin Shin is waiting and realize that they're going to have to find another way, they decide they need to leave. They go back upstairs and it says, Varen and Inktar were standing together, and thus also alone. Inktar looked a little dazed. Varen gave Rand and the other three a brief glance, frowned at their expressions, then resettled her shawl and started for the entry hall. So, I think that she could have said any number of things to Barthana's that were probably innocuous, but I'm wondering why Inktar looks dazed. And I'm wondering if she put her hand on his arm or whatever, and cupped her brooch, her little Angrial, in the other, and maybe she was using compulsion on him. I think that she was doing her little weave on him as they were talking. It was her first time truly alone with him since she joined the party, the first time that she could talk to him and 100% be certain there was no chance someone could eavesdrop, and also no chance that anyone will interrupt since that's just totally against the rules for a party in Kyrian like that. And I think that Varen took a prime opportunity to try to learn what Inktar is up to. Is he a dark friend? What's his mission? Why is he so desperate to find the horn? Or maybe rather than intel, she's just trying to redirect him or something. And I don't know if she succeeded in anything. You know, it takes time to do that weave. It's described as being very laborious and time-consuming when she's doing it in the prologue of the Path of Daggers. But there's got to be a reason that RJ describes Inktar as looking dazed. And I think that if it were something as straightforward as Varen saying to him, I know you're a dark friend, I think that that would have had a more problematic outcome. So the last interactions that we get with Varen in the Great Hunt are once they get to Falma, or once they get to Toman Head and they found Padan Fain's trail, and they're trying to determine who is going to go into Falma with Hurin after the horn and the dagger. It says, with her foot, Varen scrubbed out a wheel she had drawn in the dirt. In its place, she drew two short lines that touched at one end. Inktar and Hurin, and Matt, as he can sense the dagger if he comes close enough. You do want to go, don't you, Matt? Matt appeared torn, but he gave a jerky nod. I have to, don't I? I have to find that dagger. A third line made a bird track. Varen looked sideways at Rand. I'll go, he said. That is why I came. An odd light appeared in the Aes Sedai's eyes, a knowing glimmer that made him uneasy. To help Matt find the dagger, he said sharply, and Ingtar find the horn. And Fain, he added to himself. I have to find Fain if it isn't already too late. Varen scratched a fourth line, turning the bird track to a lopsided star. And who else? She said softly. She held the stick poised. Me, Perrin said, a hair before Loyal chimed in with, I think I would like to go too. And Uno and the other Shinarans all began clamoring to join. Perrin spoke first, Varen said, as if that settled it. She added a fifth line and drew a circle around all five. The hair on Rand's neck stirred. It was the same wheel she had rubbed out in the first place. Five ride forth, she murmured. And a little bit further on it says, What about you? Rand asked. Varen shook her head. You forget the Dimani. Her mouth twisted around the word in distaste. The only way I could help you would be if I channeled the power, and that would be no help at all if I brought those down on you. Even if they were not close enough to see, one might well feel a woman, or a man for that matter, channeling if care was not taken to keep the power channeled small. She did not look at Rand. To him she seemed ostentatious in not doing so, and Matt and Perrin were suddenly intent on their own feet. A man, Ingtar snorted. Varen Sedai, why add problems? We have enough already without supposing men channeling. But it would be well if you were there, if we have need of you. No, you five must go alone. Her foot scrubbed across the wheel drawn in the dirt, partially obliterating it. She studied each of them in turn, intent and frowning. Five will ride forth. And then a bit further. Rand peered at the sketched wheel as Ingtar went on with his instructions. It was a broken wheel now, with only four spokes. For some reason that made him shiver. He realized Varen was watching him, dark eyes bright and intent like a bird's. It took an effort to pull his gaze away and begin getting his things together. You're letting fancies take you, he told himself irritably. She can't do anything if she isn't there. So we're left at the end of the story where she just has this really ominous, almost weird sister type vibe. And all we know of her beyond that is that after Rand battles Ishamael in the sky, the girls find him and they carry him to Varen for healing. And then Min tells Rand when he wakes up that Varen has gone with the girls and Matt and Hurin, and they're headed back to Tar Valon with the horn. And when Moraine comes to him and Rand accuses her of sending Varen to shepherd him, she's like, I didn't send Varen, she did that on her own. And that's all we know of Varen throughout the Great Hunt. And so RJ kind of leaves her off on this creepy and mysterious vibe. Her whole relationship with Rand throughout Book 2 is one where he feels pushed by her, but it's like you almost don't feel as bad for him, or at least I personally don't feel as bad for him as I do when Moraine is being pushy. Because it's sort of like with Varen, she doesn't even seem as controlling. She's almost more pragmatic. She's just kind of like, this is the way it is. You know, not in the you must, you have to, forcing type of way that's Moraine's style, who gets so frustrated because she's such a control freak. Varen is so much more go with the flow. She asks Rand, after Barthanas' party, What of you, Rand Althor? Do you feel well? Do you fight it still, or have you yet surrendered to the wheel? I ride with you to find the horn, he told her. Beyond that, there is nothing between me and any Aes Sedai. Do you understand me? Nothing. She did not speak, and he walked away from her, but when he turned to take the stairs, she was still watching him, dark eyes sharp and considering. She's not telling him to do anything. She's just curious and wondering, are you still struggling? Because Varen is so go with the flow. And I guess at the point that you have accidentally stumbled into having to swear your soul to the shadow and you just roll with it, you definitely count as a go with the flow type person. So, I've been trying to ask myself why Varen decided to go to the Two Rivers. She's a major character throughout Book 2, and then we see her at the beginning of Book 3, starting in Chapter 10, and the last we see her is at the end of Chapter 22, which is A World of Dreams. She gives Egwene the dream to Tarangriel, and that's the last we see of Varen, until Book 4, when all of a sudden she's in the Two Rivers. Perrin goes home, and there she is. And so I was trying to think about what made her decide to go there, because her explanation to Perrin of, oh, well, there's fewer and fewer girls who can channel, we all know that's bullshit. The searching for girls that can channel thing, I mean, sure, it's amazing that both Egwene and Nynaeve can channel, and on the surface, that's a reasonable reason, but we all know that's not really the reason. Because, you know, Varen definitely hopped on the opportunity to insinuate herself with Moraine and Swan because she wants to help make sure that the dragon wins, and, you know, that's kind of her motivation of, yeah, I want to fight evil, but her base motivation, I think, everything else that she does is secondary to her immediate dopamine rush that she gets from her curiosity being stimulated. This is interesting. This is novel. It's a new thing to study. Basically, this whole new toy sensation that she gets. And, you know, if it can affect a positive outcome as well, that's all to the good too. But I feel like everything that she does, even in fighting the shadow, is secondary to what she's doing basically for her own happiness. Because satisfying her curiosity makes her happy. So she comes to Fel'dar at the beginning of the Great Hunt, knowing that the dragon is reborn, and I'm guessing that she has an inkling of what Swan's visit to Fel'dar is about. Swan probably just wrapped it all up in this whole banner of it will be an impromptu visit of state for whatever reason. I mean, who knows what the fuck she told people, but I don't know whether Varen got any Black Aja orders for things to take care of on the journey. I'm not even sure how much Leandrin and Alviarin even noticed her while they were in Fel'dara. In fact, I don't even know that Leandrin would know that she exists because of the way that their heart system works, but Alviarin, as the head of the Black Aja, has to know every other Black sister, so Alviarin would have known that Varen was Black Aja, and she's analytical enough and practical enough that you would think that she would keep tabs on all of her agents. But I can almost see her being super disappointed, like looking over the whole crew of Aes Sedai, seeing everybody that the Ajas picked and what dark friends got sent, because, you know, she doesn't get to decide who gets sent, that's up to the Aja heads, and being like, fuck, this is who I get? I can totally believe Alviarin could forget to give Varen orders, or else not trust her to do them right, or else just not even bother because she doesn't feel like she's actually capable of doing them with any kind of efficiency, and she just doesn't want to bother. But even before the Trolloc's attack and the Horn of Valyr theft and everything, I can see Varen being stoked for this journey to Fel'dara. Her curiosity has to be amped at the point that they get there. It's like, what a fun field trip for her. I can just see her absolutely delighted with herself, delighted with the journey, and they get there and it's like, all of the Aes Sedai will learn pretty early on that the three boys are Ta'veren. It's not a secret around the keep. Moraine has not made any bones about it. It's not hidden. And three Ta'veren is unheard of. And so it had to have been so exciting. And the Aes Sedai were all talking about it because it's part of the conversation fairly early on. And that's one of the things that informs the discussion between her and Alana. When Alana bonds Rand against his consent, Alana is saying it should have been done long ago, and she's referencing back to when they were in Fel'dara, because Alana is also one of the Aes Sedai that's in this crew of women who come with Swan. And so Alana is of the opinion that all three of the boys should have been bonded at that time because they are Ta'veren, so that they could be kept track of because it's just too dangerous to let Ta'veren run around. So I'm sure that all throughout, they're all just talking at each other, and there's just this super excitement. And Varen has always got to be thinking deeper and wondering more. What's going on? You know, she's like, okay, well, one of them is the man who channels. You know, this guy's the dragon. And at this point, she knows, okay, well, this other kid, he's got this dagger from Shatter Logoth. That's fascinating. And she's already got her mind going with all of these, like, data models of based upon what we know. Can we do this reasonable approximation of a rate of infection? Like, just a nerd having a massive nerdgasm, and then she sees the third boy has yellow eyes. And we know Varen knows the meaning of that. She definitely knows the meaning of that by book 4, because she's the one that tells the Two Rivers people to do the Wolfhead banner while Perrin is off fighting Trollocs. He comes back to Emmon's Field, and there's this wolf banner, and she's like, wasn't that a good idea, Perrin? And he's like, fuck you, Varen. I'm sure that she knew what yellow eyes meant long before that. I don't think that she just did some quick research in the short period of time that she's in the tower and the dragon reborn before she leaves for the Two Rivers. I'm pretty positive that she already knew. So, I think that she got to Fel'dara and just hit this curiosity jackpot. And it was probably, like, the best vacation ever. I bet she gave the keep a really high Airbnb rating, like, fabulous vacation, wonderful, immersive, great adventure, great people, excellent. And then if that wasn't enough excitement, and I feel like Farron is the sort of person whose general life satisfaction increases in calamitous times, there's the girls. You know, the boys are great and exciting and they're Tavirin, but the girls... It says here, as Egwene and Nynaeve are traveling with the Ammerlin's Seat from Faldara to the river to take ship to Tarvalen. Egwene almost jumped out of her skin that first night out of Faldara when the tent flap was pushed aside and a plump, square-faced Aes Sedai with graying hair and a vaguely distracted look in her dark eyes ducked into their tent. She glanced at the lantern hanging at the highest point of the tent and the flame rose a little higher. Egwene thought she felt something, thought she almost saw something about the Aes Sedai when the flame grew brighter. Moraine had told her that one day, when she had more training, she would be able to see when another woman channeled and to tell a woman who could channel even if she did nothing. "I'm Farron Mathwan," the woman said with a smile, "and you are Egwene Alvir and Nynaeve Almira from the Two Rivers which was once Manethrin. Strong blood, that. It sings." Egwene exchanged glances with Nynaeve as they got to their feet. "Is this a summons to the Ammerlin's Seat?" Egwene asked. Farron laughed. The Aes Sedai had a smudge of ink on her nose. "Oh, my, no. The Ammerlin has more important things to deal with than two young women who were not even novices yet. Although you never can tell, you both have considerable potential, especially you, Nynaeve. One day..." She paused, rubbing a finger thoughtfully right atop the ink smudge. "But this is not one day. I am here to give you a lesson, Egwene. You have been poking in ahead of yourself, I fear." Nervously, Egwene looked at Nynaeve. "What have I done? Nothing that I'm aware of." "Oh, nothing wrong. Not exactly. Somewhat dangerous, perhaps, but not exactly wrong." Farron lowered herself to the canvas floor, folding her legs under her. "Sit, both of you. Sit, I don't mean to crane my neck." She shifted around until she had a comfortable position. "Sit." Egwene settled cross-legged across from the Aes Sedai and did her best not to look at Nynaeve. "No need to look guilty until I know if I am, and maybe not then. What is it I've done that's dangerous but not exactly wrong?" "Why, you've been channeling the power, child." Egwene could only gape. Nynaeve burst out, "That is ridiculous. Why are we going to Tarvalen if not for that?" Moraine Sedai has been giving me lessons," Egwene managed. Farron held up her hands for quiet, and they fell silent. She might seem vague, but she was Aes Sedai, after all. "Child, do you think Aes Sedai immediately teach every girl who says she wants to be one of us how to channel? Well, I suppose you are not exactly every girl, but just the same." She shook her head gravely. And then a little bit further it says, "Most girls who want to become Aes Sedai, even most girls with the seed inside them like you, are afraid of it, too. Even after they reach the tower, even after they've learned what to do and how, for months they need to be led step by step by a sister or by one of the accepted. But not you. From what Moraine tells me, you leaped into it as soon as you knew you could, fumbling your way through the dark, with never a thought of whether there was a bottomless pit under your next step. Oh, there have been others like you. You were not unique. Moraine was one herself. Once she knew what you had done, there was nothing for it but for her to begin teaching you. Did Moraine never explain any of this to you?" "Never." Egwene wished her voice was not so breathless. "She had other matters to deal with." Nynaeve snorted softly. "Well, Moraine has never believed in telling anyone anything they did not need to know. Knowing serves no real purpose, but then neither does not knowing. Myself, I always prefer knowing to not." "Is there one? A pit, I mean?" "Obviously not so far," Farron said, tilting her head. "But the next step?" She shrugged. "You see, child, the more you try to touch the true source, the more you try to channel the one power, the easier it becomes to actually do it. Yes, in the beginning you stretch out to the source, and more often than not it is like grasping at air, or you actually touch Sidar, but even when you feel the one power flowing through you, you find you can do nothing with it, or you do something and it isn't what you intended at all. That is the danger. Usually, with guidance and training and the girl's own fear slowing her down, the ability to touch the source and the ability to channel the power come together with the ability to control what she is doing. But you began trying to channel without anyone there to teach you any control at all of what you do. I know you don't think you're very far along, and you are not, but you were like someone who has taught herself to run up hills, sometimes at least, without ever learning how to run down the other side or to walk. Sooner or later you are going to fall if you don't learn the rest of it. Now, I'm not talking about anything like what happens when one of those poor men begins channeling. You will not go mad. You won't die, not with sisters to teach and guide you. But what might you do entirely by accident, never meaning to?" For an instant the vagueness had dropped from Varen's eyes. For an instant, it seemed, the Aes Sedai's gaze had flicked from Egwene to Nynaeve as sharply as the Ammerlin's had. "Your innate abilities are strong, child, and they will grow stronger. You must learn to control them before you harm yourself or someone else or a great many people. That is what Moraine was trying to teach you. That is what I will try to help you with tonight, and what a sister will help you with every night until we put you into Shiriam's most capable hands. She is the mistress of novices." Egwene thought, can she know about Rand? It isn't possible. She'd never have let him leave Faldara if she even suspected, but she was sure she had not imagined what she saw. So in this scene, it's probably about 10 months before Varen arrives in the Two Rivers. But I think that her desire to go there has to have been ignited from the beginning, or to have been ignited from the point that she was in Faldara, because there are so many interesting Two Rivers people. At this point, she's had this interaction with the boys, and I think that to keep the meeting with Rand from being particularly noteworthy, you know, the Ammerlin told him, I'll meet with Matt and Perrin as well, and I think that Varen and Moraine were with her in those meetings too, to keep them, like, exactly the same, so that it would be the same for all three boys. And now she's had this interaction with the girls, where she gives them this lesson. So she works with Egwene, and then she has Egwene sit aside and works just with Nynaeve, and then Nynaeve in her rage lights the blankets on fire, and for Varen, she's gonna leave the lesson and go to her tent and start taking notes and asking herself, what kind of place spawned all of these people? So, she spends the rest of the Great Hunt following after Rand and helping to find the Horn, but all of that time, you know, hanging out with the boys and probably having Tavirin work on her to a certain extent, it had to increase this itch to go and check out this place, this origin of these people with this old blood of Manethrin. You know, what is this place like? Where are these people from? When we next see Varen after the Great Hunt, it's in Chapter 10 of The Dragon Reborn. She has spent all winter traveling cross-continent with the girls and Matt and Hirin. And, you know, I've asked myself, why cross-continent? It says, from Egwene's point of view, they were six altogether, all plainly dressed enough not to stand out in the villages and small towns they had encountered, yet perhaps as odd a party as had crossed the Carolane grass any time recently, four of them women, and one of the men in a litter slung between two horses. The litter horses carry light packs as well with supplies for the long stretches between villages the way they had come. So the way that that's written lets you know they did not go a usual way. And, you know, from Falma, there's some real specific pathways that you can go. There's major trade routes, there's the road up through Maradon and along the borderlands, and then there's the major road south. But cross-country, not so much, because there's a big mountain range, and there's not really countries or inhabited lands. So going directly across the continent seems like a very strange path to take. The back roads may be less distance by the way the crow flies, but as far as actual distance or the time it took them to travel on road by land, I don't think that going cross-continent was the fastest way to go at all. So I'm wondering if she took that weird route so that she didn't have to check in. Like, she drove through the middle of nowhere specifically so there would never be cell service, so that she would never be in a place where there would be pigeons, so she would never have access to anything where she'd be able to have contact with dark friends. That gives her absolute plausible deniability, where she could be like, I'm sorry, I couldn't get into contact. There was no way. I had no pigeons. I had no access. I was in the middle of nowhere, you know? I'm sorry, Verizon sucks. So she wouldn't be in any place where she could be told that she would need to kill the girls or given any other dubious orders. But I'm also wondering, was she dragging it out as long as she could so that Matt would die? When they get to Tarvalen and Swan debriefs her, Varen kind of makes it sound like she's making a case for letting Matt die. It says, "So long as Matt lives," Varen went on, "the Horn of Valyr is no more than a horn to anyone else. If he dies, of course, another can sound it and forge a new link between man and horn." Her gaze was steady and untroubled by what she seemed to be suggesting. "Many will die before we are done, daughter. And who else could I use to sound it again? I'll not take the risk of trying to return it to Moraine now. One of the Gaidin, perhaps. Perhaps. The pattern has yet to make his fate clear." "Yes, mother. And the horn?" "For the moment," the Ammerlin said finally, We will find some place to hide this where no one but we two know. I will consider what to do after that. Vera nodded. As you say, Mother. Of course, a few hours will make one decision for you. It's really funny that she can be so callously offering up Matt's death. Like, it really does seem like she feels that that is the best choice. And I don't know if she feels like that because she knows the type of person that Matt is, having spent enough time with him to know that, yeah, he's not going to be reliable. It will be too much of a hassle to try to keep track of him. It will be a nightmare to try and direct him. And it's probably going to be for the best to just let him die and find someone more obedient and steadfast to blow the horn. And she's coldly pragmatic enough to feel like, yeah, that's probably better that you should just let him die. And it's funny to see her so coolly suggesting such a terrible fate for someone that she has traveled with for nearly a year, when two chapters before she is so genuinely outraged when the girls use the One Power as a weapon against the White Cloaks as they're heading into Tar Valon, and Dane Bornhold accosts their party and Egwene loses her shit and blows up the ground. It says, Varen was wide-eyed with astonishment and anger. Her mouth worked furiously, but whatever she might be saying was lost in the thunder. And a little bit further on. What you have done, Varen began, then stopped to take a deep breath. Her stare took in all three of the younger women. What you have done is an abomination. An abomination! An Aes Sedai does not use the power as a weapon except against Shadowspawn, or in the last extreme to defend her life. The three oaths... They were ready to kill us, Nynaeve broke in heatedly. Kill us or carry us off to be tortured. He was giving the order. It was not really using the power as a weapon, Varen Sedai. Elaine held her chin high, but her voice shook. We did not hurt anyone or even try to hurt anyone. Surely, do not split hairs with me, Varen snapped. When you become full Aes Sedai, if you ever become full Aes Sedai, you will be bound to obey the three oaths, but even novices are expected to do their best to live as if already bound. What about him? Nynaeve gestured to the White Cloak officer, still standing there and looking stunned. Her face was as tight as a drum. She seemed almost as angry as the Aes Sedai. He was about to take us prisoner. Matt will die if he doesn't reach the tower soon, and... Egwene knew what Nynaeve was struggling not to say aloud. And we can't let that sack fall into any hands but the Amyrlans. Varen regarded the White Cloak wearily. He was only trying to bully us, child. He knew very well he could not make us go where we did not want, not without more trouble than he was willing to accept. Not here, not in sight of Tar Valon. I could have talked us past him with a little time and a little patience. Oh, he might well have tried to kill us if he could have done it from hiding, but no White Cloak with the brains of a goat will try harming an Aes Sedai who knows he is there. See what you have done. What stories will those men tell, and what harm will it do?
Her outrage there is absolutely genuine. And you can see that she believes in being Aes Sedai. She believes in the mission, and she believes in the oaths that she is no longer bound to uphold. And that's kind of cool. You know, in her point of view that you get in The Path of Daggers, where she's doing the compulsion on the dot saying Aes Sedai in the Aiel camp, it mentions that it's been 71 years since her last serious mistake. And as you know more about her, you know that she's alluding to when she fucked up and accidentally went a little too far with her curiosity and her exploration and ended up being forced to swear to the shadow. Varen doesn't strike me as a person who engages in constant self-recrimination, but we know that being a dark friend is shitty. It's one of those jobs where it's like poor pay, shitty hours, bad benefits, dishonest hiring practices. Like, there is nothing good that comes of it. And I think that Varen is fairly regularly reminded that she fucked up. She knows that she fucked up. And yeah, there are good things to being Black Aja in the sense that Varen is very good at attitude adjustments, and so she can find ways to engage her curiosity even in having to be quote-unquote evil. But I get the feeling that she misses her old job. I think that Varen finds the Supergirls just as fascinating in their own way as the Ta'veren boys. She seems incredibly invested in their health and safety. As they're going into the city, and Egwene is naively saying, "You're pulling up your hood, Varen. You're hiding. You're acting like you're more concerned than you've been up until now. But we're almost at the tower. Why are you behaving like you're expecting more trouble than you have this whole trip? Why are you doing that when we're almost there?" And Varen's like, "I always expect trouble, especially in the tower, and so should you." giving them a heads up and letting them know, yo, sorry to break it to you, but Tarvalin is dangerous. The White Tower is dangerous, and you should never, ever think that you're safe here. You should shut your mouth. You should be careful of the things you say. Never be foolish enough to believe that you're safe here. Varen is a teacher at heart. When she's explaining to Egwene about the world of dreams, and she's kind of drawing lines in the dust on her desk, and talking about the parallel worlds, and Egwene's like, oh, the world's reached by the portal stones, like showing that she's paid attention to lectures on the way from Toman Head. So Varen lectured them on the way back from Toman Head, and I bet she really focused on their education and made sure that they got a lot of training in while they were traveling, particularly since there were plenty of days when they were caught up in villages and they couldn't move at all. And so I think that she probably really worked hard to make sure that the girls got plenty of education over the course of the winter, partly because it's just the thing to do to keep disruptions to their training to a minimum. Partly because education and study will help keep the girls out of trouble. Partly to catch Elaine up to Egwene, since Elaine couldn't channel while they were in Falma, while Egwene learned a whole bunch of channeling while she was captive. And just as much as all of the rest, I think she did it for herself because she loves teaching. And she particularly loves teaching students like Egwene and Elaine, who are voracious and intelligent and talented. The way that teaching in the White Tower is described, like Aes Sedai teach advanced channeling to accepted and give them individual lessons about academic subjects, accepted teach basic channeling to novices, and Aes Sedai lecture to halls full of novices, so all accepted teach classes. And as would happen, some genuinely love it and are good at it. And that seems to be Varen. She's very naturally a teacher, and she enjoys teaching, especially if she has an extremely studious student. And I feel like it may have been the teacher part of her that made her reach out to Egwene with the dream Tirongriel. You know, Swan taps Varen to give Egwene and Nynaeve the information about the Black Aja. They need the list of names, and they need the information about the Tirongriel they stole. Swan has to trust somebody. And it's like, Varen already knows enough to get me fucking killed, so I might as well trust her. And we know that Varen never tells the Black Aja that the girls were sent to hunt them. She must not have, because Sheriam doesn't know that the girls are hunting the Black Aja, and Elaida doesn't know where they are. And Elaida would know where they are if Galena Kasban knew that the girls were hunting the Black Aja. But Galena doesn't know, because Varen doesn't tell. So that's just another example of Varen as a triple agent being spare with the information that she gives to her evil overlords. So, Varen summons Egwene to get the notes about the Black Aja. Varen has her come to her rooms, and she gives her the information, and then she's like, yo, I hear from Anaya that you might be a dreamer. So they've only been in the tower for a few days. Varen has been gone for nearly a year. She gets back, and she's run into people she hasn't seen in ages, and at some point in the last few days, she's engaged in a presumably nerdtastic and enthusiastic conversation with Anaya about the Two Rivers girls, because Anaya is also very much a teacher. She's motherly, she's fond of Egwene, and she was probably very curious and concerned about where the girls went off to. So knowing that they came back with Varen, especially since she and Varen were friendly, would definitely have Anaya asking questions. And Varen likely deflected and gave non-informational or non-committal responses. I mean, who knows? But Anaya at that point mentions Egwene potentially being a dreamer. I don't think Varen knew about that before then, because she says, I understand from Anaya that you might be a dreamer, and there was never any mention of it before, so I don't think she knew about any of Egwene's dreams over the course of their journey over the winter. So she's just first learning of it as they return to the tower, and at that point she's kind of like, oh, but I have that dream Tirongriel, and I don't use it because I got all fucked up that one time I used it, and traveling around Teleron Riad is not for me, and I have 50,000 other scholarly projects that I'm working on, so I set all that stuff aside. I set aside the dream Tirongriel and all of Corianna Nadil's research, but I do have it. I have the Tirongriel, and I have the research, and if Egwene is a dreamer, well, here's a student, and I have something that she might like to study. So, the scene between Varen and Egwene plays out in a really interesting way, because it feels like Varen has multiple things she wants to do here. She's doing something Swan asked her to do in giving Egwene the information about Leandrin and the others, and giving her the information about the Tirangriel. The teacher part of her is giving Egwene the dream Tirangriel and being like, yo, I hear you might be a dreamer, so here, dream away. Let's see what you can do with your talent. Nobody can teach you, but here, go off and teach yourself. And then she does a third thing. So, Egwene has just come into Varen's room, and she looks around at all of her books and all of her other awesome stuff, and she's been startled by what she thought was a stuffed owl that suddenly blinks at her. And it says, ah, yes, Varen said. She was seated behind a table as cluttered as everything else in the room, a torn page held carefully in her hands. It is you, yes. She noticed Egwene's sideways glance at the owl and said absently, he keeps down mice. They chew paper. Her gesture took in the entire room and reminded her of the page she held. Fascinating, this. Roselle of Essam claimed more than 100 pages survived the breaking, and she should have known since she wrote barely 200 years afterwards, but only this one piece still exists, so far as I know. Perhaps only this very copy. Roselle wrote that it held secrets the world could not face, and she would not speak of them plainly. I have read this page 1,000 times trying to decipher what she meant. The tiny owl blinked at Egwene again. She tried not to look at it. What does it say, Varen Sedai? Varen blinked, very much as the owl had. What does it say? It is a direct translation, mind, and reads almost like a bard reciting in high chant. Listen. Heart of the dark. Balsamon. Name hidden within name, shrouded by name. Secret buried within secret, cloaked by secret. Betrayer of hope. Ishamael betrays all hope. Truth burns and sears. Hope fails before truth. A lie is our shield. Who can stand against the heart of the dark? Who can face the betrayer of hope? Soul of shadow. Soul of the shadow. He is... She stopped with a sigh. It ends there. What do you make of it? I don't know, Egwene said. I do not like it. Well, why should you, child? Like it or understand it? I have studied it nearly 40 years, and I do neither. Varen carefully placed the page inside a silk-lined folder of stiff leather, then casually stuffed the folder into a stack of papers. But you did not come for that. She rummaged across the table, muttering to herself, several times barely catching a pile of books or manuscripts before it toppled. Finally she came up with a handful of pages, covered in a thin, spidery hand and tied with nubby string. Here, child, everything that is known about Leandrin and the women who went with her. Names, ages, Ajas, where they were born, everything I could find in the records, even how they performed in their studies. What we know of the Tirangriel they took, too, which isn't much. Only descriptions for the most part. I do not know whether any of this will help. I saw nothing of any use in this. Perhaps one of us will see something. A sudden wave of suspicion took Egwene by surprise, if she didn't leave something out. The Ommerlin seemed to trust Varen only because she had to. What if Varen was Black Aja herself? She gave herself a shake. She had traveled all the way from Tomenhead to Tarvalen with Varen, and she refused to believe this plump scholar could be a dark friend. I trust you, Varen Sedai. Can I, really? The Aes Sedai blinked at her again, then dismissed whatever thought had come to her with a shake of her head. So, that paper that Varen pulled out, she had to have had it out on purpose. I think that that's the third thing that's really going on in this scene. She wanted Egwene to ask about it, because I think that Varen knows Balsamon is a Shamael. She would figure it out, since that couldn't possibly have been the Dark One fighting Rand in the sky over Falma. It had to have been a Forsaken. If she hadn't figured the paper out already, based on whatever she knows of her evil peers and overlords, she would have figured that out. But regardless, she wants to pass that information on to someone else, and so she made sure that Egwene would ask about it. And it's fun to imagine what's going on in her head after Egwene says, I trust you, Varen. I imagine her looking at Egwene and blinking and shaking her head and thinking, boy, for someone so smart, you're so dumb, kid. Or some variant of it, or Jesus, are you going to learn before you get killed, or what? Anyway, Varen probably thinks that Egwene's kind of a dumbass and hopes that she lives to grow out of it. But Egwene leaves Varen's rooms, and then we get a 4-paragraph point of view from Varen, and this is the only POV that we get from her until Lord of Chaos. It says, Varen sat looking at the door for a time after it closed behind Egwene. The owl hooted softly behind her. Pulling the red box to her, she opened the lid all the way and frowned at what nearly filled the space. Page upon page, covered with a precise hand, the black ink barely faded after nearly 500 years. Corianna Nadale's notes, everything she had learned in 50 years of studying that peculiar Tirangriel, a secretive woman, Corianan. She had kept by far the greater part of her knowledge from everyone, trusting it only to these pages. Only chance and a habit of rummaging through old papers in the library had led Baron to them. As far as she could discover, no Aes Sedai besides herself knew of the Tirangriel. Corianan had managed to erase its existence from the records. Once again, she considered burning the manuscript, just as she had considered giving it to Egwene. But destroying knowledge, any knowledge, was anathema to her. And for the other? No, it is best by far to leave things as they are. What will happen will happen. She let the lid drop shut. Now where did I put that page? Frowning, she began to search the stacks of books and papers for the leather folder. Egwene was already out of her mind. And that's a cool POV, partly because it does let us know that, yeah, Varen is a little bit scatterbrained, but she also works with tremendous intent and weighs what she does. But the irony of her thinking, oh, Corianan was a secretive woman, when it seems like Varen is the epitome of secretive. She gives Moraine a run for her money, and in the end she's more secretive than Moraine, because even when you know Varen's motives, in the end you don't really know her motives. She does good, but it really seems like her ultimate goal in life is just to be happy. And what makes her happy is fulfilling her curiosity. And that's a case of serving oneself. And anyone who fully just serves oneself first, and that's their goal, is slightly suspect. So, I'm wondering if Varen didn't give Egwene Corianan's notes, just in case the Black Aja found out that she gave her the dream Tirangriel, so it wouldn't look like she was helping her. She could just be like, well, I gave it to her in the hopes that she would crash and burn. It nearly killed me. And she was dumb enough to say, fuck yeah, I totally want to use this thing. I have no idea what it really does. I mean, does that really sound like I was trying to help her? It's just total plausible deniability. When really, Varen gives it to Egwene, figuring she's a dreamer, and this will probably help her, and we'll just let this play out. Maybe she figured that because Corianan really could barely be called a dreamer, her research might not be helpful. Egwene is who she is. She's from where she's from. She's a friend to 3 Tavirin boys, and she's probably going to be the dreamiest of the dreamers. And therefore, maybe it's best to just give her a clean slate and let her write the book for herself and not bog her down with Corianan's notes. I'm not sure which was motivating Baron or whether it was both. But I think that at the point that she summoned Egwene and gave her that stuff, gave her the Black Aja notes, and gave her the dream Tirangriel, I think Varen has already decided she has got to go and visit the Two Rivers. She's got to check this place out. The people that it produces are fascinating, and she wants to get to the heart of it and find out what is this place, you know, this magical, magical place that produces these kind of magical people. She has spent the better part of a year in the company of Two Rivers people. She's traveled all the way across the world with the 3 Tavirin boys, with Quiet Perrin, who she knows can talk to wolves because she knows what golden eyes mean. Ingtar told her that Perrin was a sniffer. She rides up and she's like, Rand's gone with the Ogier and your sniffer. And he's like, well, we can still track the horn. This man has the ability to. And she looks at Perrin and is like, oh, how providential. Just bullshit. And she presumably is figuring to herself that he's using his ability with the wolves somehow to track the horn. And so that makes him really interesting. And Rand is the dragon, so it goes without saying that he's interesting. And I'm sure she wants to kill Matt, but that doesn't mean that what's going on with him is not incredibly interesting. And she had to have been taking notes after every time she healed him, because that's her way of getting all her data and stuff. And then, when they get to Tarfallon, she's part of the circle that heals Matt. We get this scene because the girls are watching, and as the Aes Sedai are breaking Matt's bond with the dagger, he's screaming at them in the old tongue that he's his own man, and he's also ordering soldiers. When they've broken the bond, they stuff the Shattered Logoth dagger in a lead box, and he just collapses on the table, and it says, "Fascinating," Varen said, "that the old blood could flow so strongly in anyone today." She and Seraphel put their heads together, talking softly but with many gestures. So it's sort of like All along, she's had Perrin being obviously super fascinating and Rand obviously totally fascinating, and Matt being mostly annoying and just kind of like a vector of this cool disease, and now he is suddenly shown, holy shit, fascinating. And a little bit further on, it says, as Swan has sent somebody to have Matt taken back to his room, it says, when she left to summon bearers, several of the other Aes Sedai left too, including Anaya. Varen and Seraphel followed, still talking to one another too quietly for Egwene to make out what they said. So, I think that that was just the final thing. Varen's like, fucking dragon reborn, guy who can talk to wolves, and whatever the shit is happening with this kid who's admittedly annoying, but now he's spouting off the old tongue and commanding soldiers in an ancient battle, and oh, also these two girls who are both scary intelligent, incredibly powerful channelers, and what the fuck is up with this place? But Varen doesn't want to go to the Two Rivers alone. She's going to want a companion, and she needs the right kind of companion. She needs the kind of companion where she can get away with what she wants to get away with. She wants somebody that she can pretty easily manipulate, somebody who's a little showy and will draw more attention so that she can fade in the background a bit. She'd like to have presumably someone who's got more than one warder, so of course a green sister. And Alana was perfect, because Alana was at Faldara, so she had already had exposure to the boys and knew who and what they were, and Varen could then play on her curiosity. Alana was part of this circle that heals Matt, so Varen just has to be like, hey, I want to go check this place out. And at the point that Varen goes and proposes it to her, I don't know that she's proposed it to her at the point that Egwene has her acceptance test, which is right after Varen gives her the dream Tarangriel, but in my headcanon, Varen has already decided that she's going when Egwene leaves her study and meets Shirium, who takes her down to her acceptance test, and she's just deciding, I'm going to ask Alana to come with me. Alana will be easy to manipulate, she's got volatile emotions, we're the same level in power, but Alana has to defer to me because I'm like 100 years older than she is. And I don't know if they wrote up a proposal and submitted it to the Ammerlin, or if they just packed their shit and left, I don't exactly know how that works. But within 6 weeks, give or take, they're in Watch Hill. And I get that number because it takes maybe 2 weeks for the girls to get to Tyr, and a few more days for the stone to fall, and when the Shadow Rising starts, they've been in Tyr a month, and then Perrin heads home via the Ways. So I think Varen finishes up whatever nerdery she's got going on after Egwene leaves her study, and the next day hits Alana up and is like, hey, let's pack our shit, and then they leave within a couple of days after the girls leave Tarvalen. I'm wondering if maybe Varen chose to leave also so that she could get out of the tower before the Black Aja decided to put her to any kind of use. I don't know that I think that she got sent to the Two Rivers under Black Aja orders. It feels like that's another thing she chose to do on her own. I think she was like, I've got minimal time before I'm going to get tapped to do something that's not going to be serving my own curiosity, but is instead going to be serving some kind of course of evil. And while I'll probably be able to roll with it and find something that will serve my curiosity there, I would rather serve myself and not do evil. So, hey, Alana, you want to go to the Two Rivers with me and explore? And Alana is like, well, yeah, I mean, Egwene won't let me do dishes with her and hang out and ask her all kinds of inappropriate personal questions about her ex-fiancé, so yeah, let's go creep on their house instead. And they take off, and we don't see them again until book 4 when Perrin goes home. And that is just the beginning of Varen's fascinating journey of being a tertiary character where really everything that she does, someone else could do, and she is a character that they could totally cut from the series without having to do anything beyond some minor shifts, but it would be fucking tragic if they did, because she is so amazing, and if they find the right actor to play her, she will be a delight. She will be a delight because Varen is a delight. She is the character that I am most stoked to see. Seriously, Rafe, show us Varen. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Podcast of the Dragon. These ones where a lot of it is open to speculation are really fun. You know, I haven't even totally made up my mind about everything, and I feel like I could change it a lot with Varen because she's so mysterious, and that's great. You can find me on Twitter at Warder Gray. That's Gray with an E. All of my links are down in the show notes. There's a link for my email if you want to drop me a line, for my Discord if you want to come and join and hang out,
for Watt Trivia and Games, and that's a super fun Discord if you want to play games with people, and there's a whole group of people to hang out with. And there's a link for the Watt Fandom and Calendar Discord if you want access to a ton of different Wheel of Time content creators. There's also a link to my Patreon if you would like to support the show and have access to some really cool bonus content. If you could rate and review me on iTunes/Apple Music, that would help me out a lot. If you know anyone who likes the Wheel of Time and might be interested in a different kind of podcast, please tell them about me. My music is by Kevin MacLeod. I'm the Grey Warder. And because I've never been much of a prattler, when I want to disarm my evil peers and overlords, I just say... Wait. I lost my train of thought.